This is Peter Angood from National Quality Forum. I'm the Senior Advisor for Patient Safety. And with us today from the NQF staff, we have Lindsay Tai, one of our research analysts, and Melinda Murphy, a consultant who is with us regularly with NQF, and in particular for this project because she historically was involved with the development of the Serious Reportable Events Program and their revisions. We also have Ann Hammersmith on, our general counsel, who will only be with us for a few minutes at the beginning. I am just serving to get us started. Hopefully you will all have your materials and will have had an opportunity to review all of those. The agenda, I'll just make these couple of comments, and I'm going to ask Lindsay to do a roll call. And with the roll call, after that's completed, I'll turn this over to Eric, and we'll do some general introductions, get each of you to make a short introduction of yourself, give us a bit more of your background directly, since this is all being done by audio, and we don't have the benefit of the face-to-face meeting. At the end of the introductions, Ann Hammersmith will take us briefly through the disclosures of interest. This is a routine part of the NQF processes, and then we'll get ourselves formally into the conference activities overall. So, Lindsay, if you could do a roll call right now, that would be great.
Dr. Tangelos?
Yes, Eric Tangelos.
Dr. Baker John? Dr. Gravenstein? Dr. Huss?
Present.
Ms. Jelinek?
Yes.
Dr. Lett?
Yes.
Dr. Wagner?
Present.
Great. Thanks. And Lindsay, if you could email those two that did not respond just to see if they're going to be able to join us a little bit later.
Okay.
I'm a little surprised. It's Deborah Bakurgian, and Stefan, you know, I'm surprised. They should be on.
Yeah, I just sometimes little prompts here and there will work.
Right.
So, well, Eric, why don't you go ahead and just do a short bio of yourself, and then we'll go down the list, and then we'll do the conflicts of interest.
Sure. Eric Tangelos, I think you all know me. Currently chair emeritus in a division of primary care here at Mayo Clinic, past president of AMDA, board of AGS, board of ACP, and been involved with quality projects for a long, long time here at Mayo, chief quality officer for the Department of Medicine when we first did that, and then still active with Joint Commission and NCQA as well. I'm happy to be chairing this group.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Huss?
Yeah, Randy Huss. I'm a family medicine geriatrician based in Rolla, Missouri. I'm also administrative physician, division president with St. John's Clinic, a multi-specialty large integrated physician group with an integrated health system. I've been involved in long-term care for probably 25 or 6 or 7 years, medical director that long. And I have been involved at American Medical Directors Association and board and leadership activities during that time. Also, one of my cross-clinic or clinic-wide responsibilities in my administrative role is for clinical quality and patient safety.
Great. Great. Thank you. Dr. Jelinek?
Oh, I'm not a physician. This is Gloria Jelinek. I am Vice President of Regulatory and Quality Management for Kindred Healthcare. I'm a master's level prepared nurse and an attorney. I've been in long-term care since 92, although I've been a nurse for a long time. Grew up in the Henry Ford Hospital System where I did my nursing practice. Currently, I oversee in Kindred Healthcare the regulatory aspect of approximately 230 nursing homes, and I'm also involved, very much involved in the quality aspect. I'm a state examiner for quality for the state of Kentucky, as well as American Healthcare Association. I review quality awards for that organization, and have been very involved in reportable events, helped design the reportable event system here at Kindred Healthcare.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Lett?
Oh, hi, I'm Jim Lett. I'm a family physician and geriatrician in Carmichael, California, where, by the way, it's 6:13.
You get the hero cookies today, that's for sure.
I've been involved in long-term care as both a practicing physician and medical director for over 25 years. Also deeply involved with AMDA, as are Randy and Eric, previously president of AMDA, and have taken part in a lot of their activities on their board, and just recently was chair of their work group to create a clinical practice guideline for care transitions to the long-term care continuum. As far as quality, I was senior medical director for LaMetra, which was the quality improvement organization for California for several years, and work with NQF in that capacity. Most recently, believe it or not, I worked for the California Department of Corrections, the prisons, in their ill-fated and budget-strapped attempt to build 7 new long-term care facilities for frail and aging prisoners. No longer with them at this time, just doing some independent consulting work.
Great. Good background as well. Thank you so much. Dr. Wagner?
Hi, I'm Laura Wagner, and I'm a nursing research scientist. Currently, I'm working at Baycrest in Toronto. I've been here for 5 years. And prior to that, I was at Emory University, where I studied under Liz Capizzuti and Joe Auslander. And at the end of the month, I'm actually moving to New York University, where I'm going into a faculty position at the College of Nursing. And my research has primarily focused on patient safety issues in nursing homes. I've done studies on adverse event reporting in nursing homes, just completed a national survey with nursing homes and departments of health that was funded by ARC, completing a study on adverse event disclosure among nurses working in nursing home settings, and currently working on some studies on mental health and safety. So.
Terrific. Thank you. Well, that's quite a stellar panel we have here. Anyone else that we have not included, or did anyone else join?
Yeah, this is Deb Bakurji, and I'm on now. It took me a while.
Terrific.
They asked me a ton of questions.
Oh, wow. You know, it's Washington, and we've got to have high security everywhere.
No.
I'm just teasing. Go ahead, Deb. We're just short intros of each other.
My name is Deb Bakurji, and I am, like Jim, in lovely California. It's 15 a.m. And I am a nurse practitioner, have been a nurse practitioner for over 20 years, working in nursing homes. I am very involved in safety efforts, mostly at a practical level, at the consulting level. And I am a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Davis, at the new Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing, and will be going into a faculty position there in September. In previous to that, I was at the University of California, San Francisco. I am very involved in the Gerontological Advanced Practice Nurses Association, and a member of AMDA, and also of California Long-Term Care Medicine, where I've done a lot of coordinating of educational activities there, and we most recently did a large seminar on patient safety in nursing homes. One of the things that got me very intrigued and passionate about patient safety is a project that I worked on actually with Jim through LaMetra, looking at patient safety in the military healthcare system. So I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that. And anyone else we missed? Okay, well, that certainly gives us a quorum. As I mentioned at the beginning, my name is Peter Angood. I'm Senior Advisor for Patient Safety. I'm a surgeon by background. I spent 25 years doing trauma and critical care in a variety of academic institutions. Was at the Joint Commission for a little over 4 years, looking after all of their patient safety programs. And I've been here now for a year and a half, looking after the safety programs. Melinda Murphy is with us. She's a nurse from background, spent a lot of years in a few different systems, but also spent some time within the VA system. And as I mentioned at the beginning, quite experienced with the NQF in a variety of capacities. She loves patient safety and has basically been a part of the Serious Reportable Events program from inception almost. And then Lindsay Tai is one of our research assistants, and she's getting her feet wet in the junior career mode with NQF as a startup and doing excellent work for us. And with all of that, I think we'll turn it over to Ann Hammersmith, who's our general counsel. And this is part of our routine in terms of just assessing for any potential of conflicts of interest, et cetera. So, Ann, please.
Good morning, everyone. As Peter said, this is the part of the meeting where we do a disclosure of interest exercise. If you recall, you should have all received disclosure of interest forms from NQF that you filled out and turned in. And, of course, we reviewed those. But in the spirit of openness and transparency, what we like to do is have an oral disclosure at the initial meeting of a given committee or panel. So what I'd like to ask you to do is go around the virtual table, and you don't need to repeat what you said in your introduction, but please indicate if there's anything else you feel that your fellow committee members should know about you and if you believe you do or do not have a conflict of interest. So Peter or Lindsay, could you call people's names, please?
Go ahead, Lindsay.
Hi, Dr. Tangelos?
Yes, I've stated that I've worked with Joint Commission, NCQA, and the AMA. I also chair the Omnicare P&T Committee and do not believe that any of these activities conflict with what our purposes are.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Bakurjian?
Yes. I guess I didn't mention that I'm on the steering committee of the Advancing Excellence in America's Nursing Homes. But I can't think of any reason why there would be a conflict of interest in that.
Okay, thank you.
Has Dr. Gravenstein joined? Hey, Dr. Huss?
The only thing I can think of, I'm on the senior executive council leadership and the board of St. John's Health System and St. John's Clinic. We do have a nursing facility. I can't imagine there's any conflict of interest, however, with any of this.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Jelinek?
I am on the regulatory committee for American Healthcare Association, but with my employment here at Kindred Healthcare, I don't believe that I have any conflict of interest.
Thank you.
Dr. Lett?
I can't believe any of my activities would have any conflict of interest with this panel. I did have an odd question. They kept asking me when I called in if I was an investor, so I don't know if that means anything.
I think you got a badly confused telephone operator.
Didn't know if that had any relevance, but thank you.
That's cute.
Okay. Dr. Wagner?
I've done some consulting on bed and side rail safety for KCI, but I don't see how it would conflict with what we're doing.
Okay, thank you.
I think that's it. Anne?
Anybody else? Okay, at this time, I'm going to invite you to ask any questions you have of me or anything that you'd like to discuss with your fellow committee members regarding the disclosures. And usually there is total silence at this point, so I'm going to assume that you don't have anything you want to bring up, and thank you all very much.
Thanks, Ann. Appreciate your joining us.
Sure.
All right. I'll just give a very short recap of this project, and then Eric will take over and run us through everything. Actually, I'll do a short thing. I'm going to ask Melinda Murphy as well to just give a short couple of words of context and her view of the process because of her background involvement in the prior versions of SREs. But and we're not going to do a full orientation talk here again today. I just want to take a moment that, you know, the serious reportable events program at NQF is obviously a high-profile program. It gets taken up across a variety of venues, including the state-based reporting entities. It's incorporated into the common formats of the Patient Safety Organization Initiative, which is federal reporting. A number of payers utilize them, as well as a number of other reporting-type entities. They also get viewed internationally with great interest, and there's a few different countries that have begun to take on similar types of projects. We are in the processes of moving along with trying to integrate the serious reportable events with the safe practices with our patient safety measures, and we're also in the very final steps of getting our board approval for the framework report that we've just produced on public reporting of patient safety events. And so those three programs plus that framework report are forming the core of the patient safety activities. This project is funded through contract work with the Department of Health and Human Services. That's a large, multifaceted contract with a number of years of involvement with that. And this expansion into new environments has been a direct request from the Department of Health and Human Services to, you know, look at the existing serious reportable events, not only in terms of the primary list, but also in terms of these three new environments, and then for us to look at potential new serious reportable events for the full list, as well as for three new environments, and the skilled nursing facility environment being one of those three environments. So it's part of a big puzzle piece, but I'd like to just strongly emphasize how important this particular program is because of its uptake on such a broad platform out there. So I'll limit my comments to that, and I was just trying to think if we had any other kind of nuts and bolts. I just did want to reassure you all that, yes, it is a long call. Yes, we feel bad we aren't doing face-to-face, but with this DHHS contract, they're trying to make us live as close to minimal resources as possible. And so a long call will be a test of everyone. We will plan for some breaks in here. We don't have to go the entire 4 hours, but if we do, we'll leave it to Eric to sort of adjudicate when to take the breaks. And I think if there are any technical problems, don't hesitate to let us know. And if there are any reasons that you need to drop off, even for a short little bit, please just let us know that you're off the line for a little bit, and then we'll go from there. So, Melinda, did you want to make a couple of comments, please, and then we'll turn it over to Eric to run us through.
Thank you. When the project started, when the Serious Reportable Events project started, it really was focused on events that could form a basis for state-based event reporting. So it was looking at the states and collecting information from the states and involving the states in reporting on incidents that they for organizations which they regulated. So that was 2002 when that first one was published, seven events, one of the first projects that NQF had after it began. And then in 2006 when it was updated, the original 27 events were evaluated, changes made to them, but material changes made to only three of the events and to specifications of only four of the events and one added. So while the whole slate of events was intended that it would apply to any healthcare organizations, particularly regulated by the states, the focus was on hospitals and has continued to be on hospitals. So this is the first time that looking at the serious reportable events has really focused on trying to make them specific for different settings of care. And one of the things that has been a discussion and important point is looking at what the supporting evidence is. And so this group will be looking for some of that, looking at what unintended consequences might be, looking in an in-depth kind of way, in a way that previous groups that have worked at these haven't in a really structured way. And I would close by saying that in listening to your introductions, it's a very impressive group that it's clear to me will be looking for what goes behind the events. So thank you.
Thanks, Melinda. So, Eric, We'll now turn this all over to you as the chair of this technical advisory panel, and we'll be here for comments and to add added perspective as needed.
We will do our best. All right, so the 28 reportable events have been mostly for the hospital. There have been commissioned three new TAPs, the skilled care being one of them, the physician office being another, and the ambulatory office-based surgery yet another. Our task is to look at both the existing serious reportable events and then take a look at the newly submitted ones as well. And then our recommendations and advice will work their way up through a variety of committees, including the one where the chairs of these different TAPs sit as well, to go forward with the activities. If you've logged on, you should have Lindsay's computer screen in front of you, currently saying screen sharing. You're best to open it up to a full screen size, because for the most part, we're going to walk across an Excel spreadsheet. And Lindsay, you want to get back to where we are with the spreadsheet?
Okay, it's loading on my end, so let me know when you see it.
You received over the last 2 weeks a number of additional documents. You received, I think, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different packets, if you were to go through them, on SREs that were new surgery, product device, patient protection, care management, environmental, and criminal. And in truth, there is action for the skilled care TEP in every one of those universes. So we've got quite a task before us to go through, remembering that these SREs have to meet certain guidelines. They must be unambiguous, preventable, and serious. And I'll hold additional editorial comment for some of them that I actually think will give us the most difficulty, some that we'll be able to walk through very quickly, and some that are actually fascinating and very fun to think about including them. So, Lindsay, we want to start. The plan was to work off of the Excel spreadsheet for the most part. Is that correct?
That is, and using the templates that were sent out last week as a guide to.
Right. So everybody should have the template sheets as well. And are we just going to ask for comments on the template sheets, or do we expect everybody to fill one out for each of the events that we're going to discuss? Lindsay? Hello?
Hi, it's Melinda. We might have lost Lindsay for a moment, but she and I worked together. And what we had envisioned is that the templates would be used by the individual members as their worksheets as they were reviewing it. And then the discussion, so you would not necessarily need to have them filled out completely, and you certainly won't be asked to submit them. And then out of the discussion and answering the questions as a group, we will capture that information.
Good.
For a combined response.
All right, that's about what I would have expected as well. And I hope everybody looked at these with regards to the three categories: unambiguous, preventable, and serious, and we'll go from there. So the first event to look at is surgery performed on the wrong body part. And I think with each of our discussions, we have to decide if it's applicable to the environment that we're talking about, the skilled environment. And it's very interesting, if you go through the applications themselves, some of the submissions included the skilled environment almost in a pattern bombing kind of activity. They've included all the environments. In others, it would seem, were a little bit more selective. And so on the same topic. Some thought that the inclusion was appropriate, some thought that it wasn't. So that's by way of introduction and what I looked at as well. So surgery performed on the wrong body part, does it have reference to the work that we do in skilled nursing facilities?
Can I ask a question before we start?
Please.
This is Laura. Are we talking about skilled facilities only certified by Medicare? Are we also including those that are only certified by Medicaid? How are we defining nursing homes here? I think that would have may have an impact on which ones we choose ultimately.
Right.
So I know in the initial call for nominations, it included nursing homes, specifically skilled nursing facilities, and since then it has primarily just said skilled nursing facilities. So I didn't know if we wanted to have a discussion on that or if a decision has already been made.
Well, I'm not actually clear on that because each state will take it up a little bit differently
okay.
as well.
This is Peter Angood, and when we had the steering committee deliberations around which of the expanded environments should we go into, there was a reasonable amount of discussion about, you know, long-term care, skilled nursing facilities, Medicaid only, and my sense is that because of what Eric just said of the variability state by state,
mm-hmm.
that we be a little bit more inclusive rather than exclusive.
Okay.
But you guys know your environments far better than us, and if that makes sense, then that to me is the easier way to do it.
Okay.
Eric, what's your sense?
My sense is to try to be, to not try to pigeonhole it too much, and to be cautious about not just looking at exceptions. If we can come up with one exception in one state, I really don't think we want to include that kind of event. I think it has to be a little bit more broad. So I think I'd like that discussion as well. And there's a number of cases. This may be one of them where, yes, some place in the universe does this, but the expense of trying to implement it and report it across
sure.
the nation's nursing homes may not work.
Mm-hmm.
And the TAPS discussion is essentially a set of recommendations to the steering committees. If there are certain situations or issues that are highly debated or controversial, then it'll ultimately be the steering committee that makes the decision on how to move that forward. But your opinion as a TAP will be very highly valued in that process.
I just think it would be helpful if we defined what setting, like be a little more descriptive about it. So, I mean, we don't have to spend too much time on this, but I think it's, you know, if you want us to be more inclusive, that's great. We just, I think, should define what that means.
Well, I think
when we're submitting our reports. So.
Yeah, well, here's the story. I think, this is a good point for you to bring it up. If you can come up with an environment in the rubric of skilled nursing facilities where surgery could be performed on the wrong body part, I think that's where this discussion
yeah.
for this particular topic ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
So go ahead and tell me in any skilled nursing environment where this could occur.
No, I'm not saying in surgery in general. I'm just saying for all of them.
Oh, no, I understand.
Yeah,
but I think some of them will
yeah.
be able to get right through
sure. okay.
That they have general applicability. But I think we need to provide guidance on some of these as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't a challenge. That was that's how I'd like to go ahead and
okay.
make this work.
Sounds good.
Okay. So general discussion on this particular reportable event.
I mean, in general, I don't think it's applicable to this setting.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I would agree.
Given the definition they provide for surgery, I'm sorry, this is Jim, I would agree that there would be so few facilities that it would be a high cost to report with a very low yield for this entire category of surgical events.
This is Gloria Jelinek, and I agree. I had written down that this wasn't applicable to a skilled nursing setting in general.
All right. So with that, Lindsay and Peter, can we move on, or do you want more discussion?
No. If it's a slam dunk, it's a slam dunk.
Let's move on. Okay, we have surgery performed on the wrong patient. And again, thinking about our environment, how applicable is this for starters?
Well, Jelinek, I think it's similar. I think it's a similar surgical issue, and that usually in nursing homes we don't see that kind of, you know, we don't do surgery. So I was thinking it wasn't applicable.
All right. The only question I had was, where do we draw the line? And here's where the ambiguous or unambiguous question comes up between surgery and a procedure. And yesterday at my skilled facility, one of the other physicians was coming out to tap a knee.
This is Peter Angu. That's a procedure. And if you look on the screen here in that first bullet in column B, again, it sort of reiterates how we view these surgical procedures. It's defined as an invasive operative procedure in which skin or mucous membranes and connective tissue is incised or an instrument introduced through a natural orifice, i.e. an endoscopy. It includes a range of procedures, minimally invasive dermatologic procedures, so biopsies, excisions, etc., and it may include the use of probes or catheters and needles or trocars.
Mm-hmm.
So a needle tap is a procedure.
Right.
And if your partner or peer
tapped the wrong knee,
then so be it. That's what he did.
That's right.
Well, this is Randy, but would that necessarily result in a serious event, though, or serious outcome?
Well,
the kind of procedures are likely to be done in a nursing home, even if they were done on the wrong body part or wrong patient. Are they really of the magnitude that we're supposed to be looking at here?
Well, what if it resulted in a diagnostic error that went back and was cultured negative and they ended up dying from an infection?
Yeah,
it's
not so much the magnitude of the outcome as much as the errors in the processes as well that let that wrong procedure occur in whatever level, at whatever level, whether it's the wrong patient, wrong part, etc.
You know, there's another piece of this that we really haven't talked about yet, and that is that while these things might not be performed, they may or may not be performed in the nursing home, our nursing home patients, our residents, have these procedures. And I wondered whether or not we should consider whether or not a resident has a surgery that shouldn't have had a surgery because of a wrong name or whatever, or whether that would be a wrong name issue. I've actually had that happen where a resident was the wrong resident was sent for a procedure, outpatient procedure.
That qualifies in my mind because that, again, suggests there was a systems
error
or process error that allowed that to happen. And while it may have been just to take a little nevus off, and that's a minor procedure with a minor outcome, but that's a huge fault in the system.
Right.
And that's the reportability and the seriousness that we're trying to utilize these types of events for.
So, I mean, in my mind, if either this situation or the situation where it's really just a tapped knee or a shoulder injection or a whatever, we'd have to go back and say even the surgery performed on the wrong body part could be applicable.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, I was thinking, like, there's surgical debridements of pressure ulcer wounds, there's suturing, you know, simple
Correct.
Surgical procedures that are conducted in this setting.
This is Jim Lett, Eric. I'm not trying to put too fine a point on it, but I get a little confused with the nomenclature. Based on the definition of surgeries here, what we're talking about happens very rarely, but the term procedures, which I use differently than surgical procedures, could include, as had been mentioned, tapping a knee, suturing, debridement of a wound. Are we talking about procedures, or are we talking about surgical procedures?
Well, when you go to column, and I won't take you back to A yet. I won't take you back to the first one that we blew right past. But if you went into the details of the submissions, there were multiple discussions and different submissions on the same reportable event. And where your thinking is right now is under the summary of suggested modifications, where others have actually thought about this and instead of submitting a new recommendation, have suggested language to help clarify and make more unambiguous the issues at hand. So some of the things that you've already started to discuss are right there in column D.
Well, that brings up, Ms. Gloria Jelinek, the point. I was going back to the first one that we blew past, and then if we're saying, if we're defining it as a procedure, then I would even think we'd have to go back and revisit the first one because it talks about surgery as well. And so.
And we will.
Okay.
Yeah, we got off in a 5-minute retrospect. We got off to a bit of a too brisk start there.
I think it was just fine, and then we'll go back and take care of it in a minute. So this opens up the discussion appropriately.
So the question I have, Eric, is that okay? So if there is the summary of suggested modifications, which says surgical and other invasive procedures rather than surgery. Is part of what we're supposed to do is say we like that recommendation, that recommended change, or we don't like it, or suggest something else? Is that
well, I think we do exactly what we're doing. As a TAP, we provide some of the nuance that is there.
Okay.
It will be distilled. We can make our suggestions, and then it will go up to the steering committees and beyond. So I think the discussion itself is the rich part to this. I think we've already hit upon that the language modifications are just as important here. The procedures do occur in the facilities. We tend to use that language more than we use surgery, but we acknowledge that this environment has those potentials.
Okay, thank you.
Peter, does that sound about right?
Yeah, you've got it very well described there, Eric. And the only other point I'd make in that for the TAP is that each of the TAP chairs are members of our steering committee so that we can have the continuity of the discussion from the TAP up into the steering committee as we move forward like this. But Eric described it nicely.
All right. And Lindsay, anything else you want before we go back to one and then come back and revisit this as well?
No, it sounds like you're on the right track.
All right, let's go back to the first one, and then we'll come back to this in just a minute. So now that everybody's coffee has kicked in, surgical events, surgery performed on the wrong body part, when we use a definition of surgery that is more procedural, when we talk about procedures, and again, surgery is inclusive in that, this kind of stuff does go on in skilled facilities.
Yes.
All right. And again, I think one of our suggestions is that indeed the modifications take into account some of the nuance that goes on in the nursing home with regards to what we actually can do. And are done. Anything else from the group? Randy?
No, I agree. If we're going to be very inclusive in the definition, these do occur. The only question would be in some of these, such as I think Peter mentioned the issue of removal of a nevus. Well, again, that's probably if it's is that serious? Again, I think we've got some nuances on what's really serious and what's not.
Okay, good point.
Yeah.
One of the things, Randy, that you may be getting at that will underlie a lot of this is that the things that happen to nursing home patients, do you place the same level of seriousness upon them because of the type of things that are done, not because of the type of patients that's there? And I think there's some strong truth to the fact that the level of intervention at the nursing home is less than you'd have in an acute hospital setting.
I think it's undeniable. I just don't know how we nuance that into this recommendation.
Well, we do that later when we talk about falls resulting in a serious injury or death or something. So I don't know if some kind of qualifier could be placed on these events as well. Like we have patient death or serious disability associated with a fall or associated with use of restraints or side rails. So some kind of qualifier in that sense may resolve that issue.
All right. So the issue here, though, is how serious is it? And I think that might be in the eye of the beholder, but we have come up with examples where a mistake can be made, and it might end up in a serious outcome for the patient.
I don't know either whether where we can say this or how we should say it, or and that has to do with cognition. I mean, there's an additional risk with some of our cognitively impaired older adults who are getting a procedure of some kind, because they may often not be able to advocate for themselves or understand what is going on, which could cause a situation where mistakes or errors could happen more readily, where a cognitively intact person might say, hey, wait a minute, that's the wrong knee. And somebody who's not cognitively, you know, who's got cognitive issues may not know what's going on at all. So that's another little nuance in here regarding that. I was thinking about looking at this preventability and the implementation guidance.
Jim, the Transitions of Care Task Force had an awful lot to do with the impaired patient not being able to serve as their own advocate. Any thoughts?
I chime in with exactly what Deb says, and as important as it is, I would ask whether or not the patient's impairness, performing surgery on the wrong body part is a serious reportable event, whether or not the patient has dementia.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And I'm not sure whether while we should always bear it in mind, I mean, depending on the study, you all know, 50-80% with cognitive impairment in a long-term care environment, I think you can assume that on a daily basis we're doing procedures on impaired patients. I think it's something to keep in mind. I'm not sure it changes the reportable event.
Oh, yeah, I would agree, Jim. I don't think it does at all. I just was thinking about whether we might suggest something in the implementation or in the preventability piece of it.
Perfect.
Yeah, and I would, as you move through the list, if you know we're trying to, make these relevant for this particular environment.
Right, and again, when you look at column E on the suggested modification, I think we really have focused on number two, body part. To sight, that's important to us, and probably under one as well, the change of wording from surgery to invasive procedure makes sense to us as well.
Right.
You know, Eric, this is Jim. The question I would ask, looking at the three unambiguous, preventable, and serious, help me with how many serious outcomes would result from what we call procedures in long-term care, that is debridement of a wound, suturing, removal of a lump and bump. I know we do, or at least I work in facilities where we have done renal dialysis, where we have done blood transfusions and endoscopy. And while I can certainly think of negative events in all those, the day-to-day quote-unquote procedures, separating that out from surgical procedures, I wonder if it meets the litmus test of serious.
Right. And, you know, that's a tough one. And as I look through all of the submissions, some provided background information that was quite extensive, others just didn't or couldn't. And this may be one of those instances where the quality organizations that are looking at these things and have submitted some of these suggested changes, and remember they have to come in through a formal process, may not have the data to back it up. So that's about all I could say to that. And I think we always run into the problem of how many events are out there. But I'll tell you, at the steering committee, I am, again, my N of one, the nursing home and the rest of it, is vastly different from what comes in at the state level and the difficulties that are experienced once you look at all of the reporting that's aggregated at a state level.
Well, and again, it's Peter Angud. Remind you that when you expand it out onto a national level, that's when you start to see the frequency and the incidence of these things, whereas in your own single facility, you may or may not have it happen.
Exactly. Exactly. So we have to suspend our judgment somewhat in that regard, because it's amazing what does happen.
Number one reported sentinel event for the Joint Commission, wrong site surgery.
For hospitals.
Yeah, but for all
yeah.
Sentinel events.
Yeah, but it's still...
Majority of sentinel events are reported from hospitals, but yeah. It's across the board.
Well, yeah. that brings the issue about, and I was thinking about this as well, is that if nursing homes do not see these issues as being important, in other words, they don't have to report them, they're probably not going to do much around making sure that there are systems in place so these errors don't happen.
Right.
Yeah.
Or that they don't happen again.
Right.
Right. Right.
That's
so,
the reportability piece.
Right. So, I mean...
But that's why we're here today.
Correct.
No, right, exactly. So I'm just saying that even though these may not be... they may not be serious... necessarily. Not every one of them is going to be maybe have meet the litmus test for serious, but I can imagine certain situations happening that surround a surgery being performed on the or a procedure on the wrong body part that has a cascading set of events that makes it serious.
Right.
And this is Gloria Jelinek. With the increasing complexity and the procedures done in nursing homes, we're going to see more and more possibility of these things occurring within the skilled facility.
Yeah.
Right. And along a similar vein, though, not to the surgical stuff, we've already talked about the fact that the wrong patient shows up, and maybe once a year, I'll have the wrong orders show up with the patient.
Yep.
So... I think we can move on to B again. And our discussion with both of these is very, very similar. Is there anything we want to add to what we've previously said about this?
Eric, this is Jim. Just for the credibility of the TAP and this whole idea of reportability, I think we're going to have to very carefully define what we're talking about when we're referring to surgical procedures and quote-unquote procedures.
And I think we've said that. I think, I mean, again, that's in the... suggested edits to how these things are defined, and we're pretty much all in agreement that needs to be clarified a little bit more.
Good, thank you.
All right. And Lindsay, what'd you do? Your computer go out again?
It appears it did. I'm working on it.
All right.
We really are in a cost-saving mode, aren't we?
embarrassingly so.
Peter, anything else before we move on?
No, you're doing what the early stages of TAPS do. You get some of the commonalities out onto the table and discuss those through, and as you hit stride, it'll get quicker and quicker.
Yep, exactly. And I think as far as the accountability, the TAPS accountability, it is going to come up. Not here, but it will come up with the issues of falls and pressure ulcers as it did in the steering committee. Let's go to the next one.
The suggested modifications that all three of these be combined into one SRE or one category of SRE. I don't know whether that's in our scope of determination or not. But
I think it's beyond us. These are the 28 that are out there right now, and I think we will play within those rules.
Just as an added comment, Gloria Jelinek, I think they should be separate, but I know we're not supposed to discuss that because they're different.
They're different events. They're in the different categories. And Lindsay, are we still having trouble?
I keep getting dropped from the conference call, sorry, so I'm not sure.
We want to go to the next one.
Okay. To C?
To C, please.
Okay.
All right. Wrong surgical procedure performed on a patient. The discussion was whether all three can be combined. They are separate. I think that's beyond our scope. We'll leave them separate and discuss them that way. Any additional or different comments? The suggested modifications, again, in column D, I bring your attention to. And again, the data is out there because hospitals report. So there's a database. What we don't know is what goes on in skilled facilities. Thoughts, comments?
Well, I think this probably is similar to the other situations. We could certainly have the same issue happen with any of our residents in the nursing home.
Yes. Yes. Anything else to add to this?
No.
All right. I think we'll move on then. Lindsay, can you give us the next one? Okay. This, again, would be another situation that would be, I think, very uncommon, though possible in the facility. And we do know that our patients are clearly getting sicker in the nursing home and skilled care in particular. And we have lots of dialysis going on right now. And any other comments here?
Yeah, just a couple, Eric. One is the example of a pressure wound that has been packed. At what point does that, and they have forgotten to remove the packing, the order's gotten lost or any other eventuality, is that an unintended retention of a foreign object? And at what point, after you've forgotten to remove it, does it become unintended retention? That's one example. Another is, I found in one lovely lady in a nursing facility, a pessary that I think was placed by Dr. Osler. The thing was so old. Is that also an unintended retention?
We had that happen in our facility, too. It was in there for years.
Dr. Osler must have been to your place, too.
It's Peter Angood, and the answer is yes to both of that. There is going to be some specific clarification around when is the end of a surgical procedure as we go through all of this revision process. But based on the first half hour discussion here, I don't think that truly impacts this environment. But the two examples you gave are just a couple of, and there are others I could think of as well, that anytime there's a foreign something left behind and it's not supposed to be left behind, that's unintended.
Yep, we get things left in ears as well.
Sure. All orifices.
All orifices, that's right. And some are placed there by patients unintentionally, but they are.
I think, again, it gets back to the parsing of the definitions so people are clear that it's unambiguous, to use the phrase we're supposed to live with.
Yeah.
Exactly. And as we go through with the steering committee deliberations on all these, we're going to do our best to remove as much of the ambiguity as we can, because it just leads to confusion. And the uptake of these SREs is so so broad, we need to get them clean as we can.
And I think that, Peter, on this one, I think it's the timing. And I'm, you know, we've got some laboratory reporting, the smoking gun kind of thing. It wasn't acted on. It was done at another location. We have to be careful about this, too. And I don't want to neglect patients, but the intent here, it looks as though, was leaving an object behind after a procedure that was an intended procedure. And a lot of the discussion we've already had is that something, I mean, we are discovering archaeologic findings on patients. And that may or may not be a different story, in that there are retained objects that the history of their placement isn't even clear.
No, I agree with you there, although the first example, though, of the wound packing left behind inadvertently is
right.
The classic.
Right, right. But but don't you agree, though, that we have to be a little bit cautious
yes.
in the way we define it in this environment?
I would agree with you there.
All right. Any other thoughts?
Well, I think about the seriousness as well. I mean, it has, and the definition of seriousness, and leaving a pessary in, for example, I mean, if it didn't result into anything, or the wound packing also, then it wouldn't be reported. So is that correct?
Well, I guess the pessary example, while it certainly happens, and they have been in there for a long time, and they've been really not creating any problem, that is a little bit of an outlier in this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But the retained wound packing gauze is very relevant to this
sure.
discussion, actually.
Yes.
And, retained, or somebody tries to remove a catheter of some sort, and there's a little bit of the catheter that gets left behind. That happens. Peritoneal dialysis catheters are one example that I can think of. So those are the sorts of things that we're really concerned and worried about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on to E. Peter, you want to remind us what a ASA class 1 patient is? You're the right guy.
I'm hopeful there's not too many class 1 patients in the nursing home facilities, but... class 1, 2, 3, 4, it's basically a grading system that the anesthesiologists have utilized for a number of years, primarily based on cardiac risk, but it has been broadened out to be operative risk overall. And a class 1 patient, in essence, is a young, otherwise healthy individual who has no significant cardiac or pulmonary or physiologic abnormalities.
So this one, maybe this one really doesn't fit for the nursing home.
I don't think so.
I actually demented and otherwise healthy. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I can't. I can't. There's no way you can get your ticket punched to get into a nursing home if you're a class 1 patient. I really don't think so.
Yeah, that's a reportable case.
Yeah.
Okay, we just presence of a ASA class 1 patient in a skilled nursing facility.
Right, exactly. No, really, it is. It doesn't happen. It shouldn't happen.
No, I understand.
Okay. Any other thoughts? I don't think this one fits for us. Let's go on, please. So did we miss anything, or are we right at devices now? We are at devices. Okay, so you've got number 10 in front of you, which is patient death or serious disability, use of contaminated drugs, services, biologics provided by the healthcare facility. Definitely our environment.
Yep.
And actually, I don't think this was ambiguous at all. It looked as though it could translate to skilled quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
Did anybody else have a thought?
No, I totally agree.
Totally agree.
All right. I don't see any reason. Peter, any reason to...
No, you're going to come across several of these SREs that you know, it's pretty clear it could be in any environment.
Right. Let's take a look at the next one then.
Do we need to discuss some of these submissions where they want to change the language or not? I mean, here it was about redefining serious disability as injury, extended hospitalization, prolonged loss of function, et cetera, et cetera. I went back and read what those definitions are, and I thought what we were given was good, but here are some requests for modifications. Do we need to discuss those?
Well, let's take up that comes up in a number of times, and let's do that right now, especially with regards to what you've already identified, the disability. It's a different universe, I think, given the premorbid state of our patients, trying to identify the additional disability. Did you want to pursue that some more? Go ahead.
I was just looking at a discussion from the group about this because I agree that many times our patients or residents are at a different functional capacity, and do we want to look at what it means to redefine their disability causing loss of function? The definition we were given is for, I think, 7 days, but this is up to 30 days. I just wanted to hear from the group as well their thoughts on redefining this.
Yeah, let's stay with that because, again, that should have caught your attention. And there were a number of comments that said, when does the hospital's responsibility end for the disability? Is it at 30 days? Well, the nursing, you do something to these nursing home patients, and they never recover to their former level of function.
Mm-hmm. Right.